Next meeting, we'll take up Senate Bill 348, supplemental appropriation for operation with the legislature. Sacadets on Facebook.
Yeah, you go ahead.
Okay, for discussion purposes, I'd like to move the CS for Senate Bill 348 that's in front of you, Finance.
I have a motion before the committee to adopt CS. All in favor? You have no objections, adopt it.
Okay, I have one amendment to the CS, sir, that came through this morning, and it's just a word further clarifying the use of the money on page one, line 15, insert Senate Resources Committee. Before the word lobbying.
Motion for the committee. All in favor? Motion carried. Amendment adopted.
With the amendment adopted, does anyone have any questions? Okay, then I would move that we incorporate the amendment into a new CS for this, whatever is appropriate, Mr. Chairman, a CS for Senate Bill 348, and move it out of committee.
Motion for the committee to incorporate it into, have a new committee substitute drafted, move out of committee. All in favor? Hearing no objection. Committee substitute, Senate Bill 348, move to committee. We have also a few bills that were assigned. Senate Bill 315, enact related to road improvement districts, Senator Bates. Senate Bill 348, we've just completed that. Senate Bill 350, enact creating the Alaska United States Olympic Trust Fund, Senator Burns. Committee substitute for House Bill 271, enact appropriations made to the Agriculture Action Council. Senate District. Committee substitute for Senate Bill 228, an act relating to state aid for Indian tribes located on certain federally established Indian reservations. Senator Jefferson. We'll move right along. This morning, we have with us Dr. Kopis from the University of Alaska, who commissioned last year by the Senate, by this body, to do a study on the correction system in the state of Alaska. Dr. Kopis taught 10 years at the Texas Criminal Justice Center. He's been an associate professor of justice at the University of Alaska for 4 years, and he's been actively engaged in the professional field of corrections research and consulting for about 15 years now. Without any more to do, I will turn it over to Dr. Kopis and his colleagues.
Thank you, Senator Brennan. Members of the committee. I'd like to first of all introduce my colleague, Dr. Bert Horn, who is an expert accountant. You could characterize accountants as experts, since he isn't. At any rate, what I'd like to do this morning is to give you a very brief overview of the major things I found out in a study which has lasted for approximately 9 months. My wife says it's about how long it takes for her to deliver a baby. That's not what it came out of the study. But at any rate, I would like to also ask that you interject at any time for questions that you may have, and anything like clarification on or anything that you would like to have expounded upon, please feel free to interrupt. There are several different distinct areas to the study, so as we go through, we'll just sort of hop from one to the other. I'd like to start out by looking at the material that we found on what are called the career ladder and the structure of corrections. And the reason that we looked at this particular area was because it is my personal belief that I think can be substantiated from any management science perspective that the success of an organization is dependent upon the quality of the members that enter into that organization and the quality of the people that an organization can maintain once they come into it. So we looked at some of the things that are normally considered positive qualities about an agency, in this case, an organization, that might attract young people into the area and retain them. And some of the things we found out, which we all have known for many years and have again verified in Alaska, is that things are not very well in corrections as far as a career is concerned. The first thing is we looked at is the wage structure. And to illustrate this very briefly, I compared the wage structure with the law enforcement field by comparing the wages at the Fairbanks Correctional Facility with the Fairbanks Police Department and the Fairbanks Detachment of Alaska State Troopers. And I discovered, to put this in perspective, that if two people went to work at the same time, one in corrections and one in law enforcement, at the end of 20 years at which retirement would be available in both agencies, the person in law enforcement would have made over $250,000 in cash more than a person going to corrections. We also find that this extends into the benefit area, such as retirement would be higher, the overall benefit associated would be higher. So corrections does operate at a disadvantage with respect to the salary structure. As far as the organization and the opportunities for a person to advance in the organization, again, a comparison of corrections with law enforcement showed that corrections, relatively speaking, again, is fairly bottom heavy. Once you go into corrections, the odds are that you're going to stay at the CO2 level without very much lateral or vertical mobility available to you. And I made some recommendations here for possible considerations of changes, and I would advocate that the legislature look very favorably upon request by the agency if they should consider creating things like a CO4 position and emphasizing the creation of specialties within the correctional bureaucracy so that people will have more of an opportunity to strive for different positions. In addition to this, I'm not really sure what the status of the bill is, but you have been asked, I believe last year, to consider making the superintendent job non-exempt job, I think we refer to it. I would advocate that this would not be a good idea, because this, for one thing, removes another potential spot from a person entering in looking at corrections as a career. And, of course, teaching in the criminal justice department with students who are looking at this profession from a career perspective, these things are of concern to myself. Moving along to the second area which the report I investigated.
The President, Senator Drew has a question.
Yes.
On the first area, we've done this for retirement purpose and so on, but is it really a fair comparison between police, public safety, and the system of corrections that we're describing? Is that a fair comparison for salary comparisons? I'm not entirely certain that you shouldn't make that comparison to people in the Department of Administration and in other agencies of government, not just those that are on the front line, and at times more apt to be putting their lives on the line and so on than guards are. And remember, I was involved very much in the effort to provide the retirement on that basis. But I don't think that's still a fair comparison. I think I wonder if you compared it to other salaries in the state and other departments, when you're speaking of the correction system. Just curious.
Not in this particular report. In Texas, I did a study similar to this, and I compared the corrections people, again, in Texas, to bus drivers, people who work in janitorial services, in companies, public school systems, whatever. And I found, again, at least in Texas a number of years ago, that they still, in corrections, fared not as well. That's a good point, Senator, but it was not done for the state of Alaska. Let me address this one thing quickly, and I think that many people believe that when we look at law enforcement, that the complexities and the demands of law enforcement as an occupation warrant a higher consideration in terms of salaries and careers. There is some legitimacy to that. I agree an officer lays his life on the line every time he makes a stop or any time he engages in action. But I would suggest that today, corrections and what's happening in corrections, and we'll see some of this later, is demanding more and more of our officers. And it is demanding that they become more sophisticated in terms of the regulations, in terms of the laws, in terms of liabilities that they are beginning to be subjected to. As far as the dangerousness aspect, with some of the liberalization that we see in corrections today, I'm not sure it's less dangerous than perhaps some police work today. So there is some debatable issues there. And I address these in the report, by the way, to some extent. Okay?
Senator Ferguson?
I'm of the same feeling that Senator Cotulla is. There certainly is a difference between law enforcement and corrections. And if you take the other scenario, it would be reduce the law enforcement down to corrections.
That was certainly a concern among some of the law enforcement people that I talked to.
that
was not my intention. And again, this is only one perspective. Again, let me emphasize, I'm looking at it as a competition of the profession of corrections to people who are in a position to consider either law enforcement or corrections as a career choice. And right now, I think, based on the considerations I've covered, law enforcement is going to win hands down. And the quality people are going to migrate toward law enforcement and not the correctional area.
One of the factors is that I believe we have to have those people exempt at the top only because there's a chance that those people aren't working out.
Any other questions for Senators?
Okay, moving along to perhaps the most interesting topic of the report, I found it to be so, because it was the newest to me. And this is an area of what has become known as the Cleary Settlement. Now, the history of the Cleary Settlement actually began under the Hammond administration, and I believe the commissioner at that time, the director at that time, was Eugene Hatrack when this first began, the earliest that I have found indications of it. And the Cleary Settlement is, in a nutshell, an agreement that has been drawn between the executive branch of government and the judiciary on the part of the plaintiffs, which Michael Cleary's name has been immortalized, I think, in the last congressional history. And it was an agreement which listed a great many conditions that the state agreed to meet. And it's a settlement which is about 75 pages in length. I emphasize that it is a settlement. It is not the process of litigation. It is not the process of trial. It was an agreement that was made between the state and the plaintiffs and their attorneys in the court, Superior Court, in Anchorage of Judge Sir Daly. And this settlement has had numerous impact. Some of it, I think, is unanticipated. Although I think it should have been anticipated, it was not. And I looked at four different areas relevant to Cleary. The first area was the impact on the morale and safety from the officer's standpoint, the correctional officer. This was the first study that I found in Alaska, by the way, that concentrated on the correctional officer. Most of what Cleary is involves the inmates, their rights and privileges. We looked at the impact of the Cleary Settlement from the perspective of the officer, and I spent many, many hours in the Fairbanks facility. Okay, this data was gathered totally in Fairbanks. It may not apply to the other institutions in the state. My opinion is it will. As far as morale goes, we asked questions like, do you think that interpersonal relations between officers due to Cleary will be affected in a positive or negative direction? We found the officers felt interpersonal relations between the officers are being affected because of the demands that Cleary has put on them. We asked things like, due to Cleary, do you feel that you were hindered in performing your duties to the level you desire? Most officers said yes. And let me just quote the comments of one officer here. It says, guys are aware that anything they do is up for question. Sometimes it's really tough to know what you, the officer, will get messed up in just trying to do your job. Sure, sometimes you say to yourself, it ain't worth the hassle, and let something small get away. While the other day an inmate told me, you can't do that. It's in violation of Cleary, and I'm going to write you up. Christ, he probably could for all I know. Things keep changing, and I'm not sure I always know the rules. But I'll tell you this, everybody I work with wants to do their job. And it's too bad those political guys in Anchorage don't show us some support. Morale problems. There are some morale problems in the institutions today, and I think the data clearly show that in part some of it can be attributed to what is happening with respect to this thing called the Cleary Settlement. And the report goes on to show more and more indications of the negative impact of morale, again, due to Cleary. As far as institutional safety goes, again, I found that the officer attitude was that, yes, safety has been challenged as far as what Cleary now is requiring the officers to do in relationship to the inmate. I did not find any indication of the actual assaults going up in the institution. I did not find any data which indicated that officers are being physically abused by inmates, nor did I find any indication inmates are physically abusing other inmates due to Cleary. But the attitudes of the officers were that the potential is beginning to emerge, that we could see a challenge to institutional safety due to the types of requirements that Cleary is placing upon the institution. And I summarize this actually on page 59 of the study you have, and I would like to say that one thing I have speculated about is that theory may enhance a dangerous possibility in corrections, and that is in group formations. We see that the officers are sticking together. We see that that there are some group identities that are emerging which have not been there before, and I think this should be a concern. I say here...
Senator Fisher?
I said officers are sticking together. Is that bad?
It's not bad, but they are identifying with their own group values and group goals. They're emphasizing their own safety. They're emphasizing their relationships with one another. And this is putting them, I think, into some type of a opposition mode with the inmate. And yes, I think this can be negative, because I prefer to see that officers interact with inmates. There's a lot of information that can be exchanged between inmates if you don't have group barriers established. And it can be negative, instead of a totally we-they type of attitude. And that's what I was getting at there. And I say that groups normally form which themselves are conflictual in nature. Most common, of course, is along racial lines. Thus, speculative result of theory is intra-institutional conflict, group formation, with the correction officers being one of the groups in addition to those along racial lines. Speculation, reconsider the response and questions about mass disturbance, superiority attitudes of inmates and physical assault potential, and the decreased amount of movement control. Also reconsider that the question about cooperation amongst the officers pointed to several officers realizing the need for sticking together more than ever. Add this to the tremendous population growth, and the pure speculation takes on the cloak of frightening reality. And I think that, again, there's some things that I have drawn from the data which ought to be of concern to us all. After looking at some of the impact on morale and safety, which again was negative from the officer's perspective, we looked at how much does it cost? What have we gotten into as far as increased operational cost due to the fact that we have entered into this agreement? I took the agreement part in detail, bit by bit. This is where Dr. Owen has been a tremendous asset to me in this endeavor. And I have attempted to develop an economic model that can be pressed upon any institution involved with Cleary to assess a monthly cost of what Cleary is incurring upon the state. And to illustrate that, if I may, the easiest one to see is on page 64, where we look at one of the Cleary elements, and it is headed heat, lighting, ventilation, and plumbing. Let me just illustrate how the Cleary settlement has put a tremendous cost burden. And let me qualify that by saying the optimal cost burden that the state would likely have to incur if it were to meet total compliance of the Cleary settlement. The Cleary says that every day, 7 days a week, that the institution shall monitor and record data on the temperature, the lighting, the ventilation, and plumbing of any location where an inmate eats, sleeps, lives, or works. In the Fairbanks Institution, that was determined to be 144 checkpoints. I accompanied the Cleary monitors one day with a stopwatch, and I measured how much time it took from point to point to point in order to take a thermometer, walk into a cell, take the temperature, check the ventilation, check the light, check to be sure that the plumbing was working, and record the data. It took approximately 4 minutes per checkpoint to travel to the checkpoint, do the work, and move on. Now, if you turn that into a cost figure on a monthly basis, it cost about $24 an hour to the state, that includes the benefits, for a CO2. If you turn that into a cost figure, we find that it comes out to be $7,142 a month. That is going to cost the state to be sure that the temperature of the cells and the heating and the lighting, according to what the Cleary settlement says we should do. Now, to me, that's a lot of money. That's a month. Turn it into a year's cost, and you're talking in many thousands of dollars. We go on and on to the report, and we look at each one of the cost elements. And I developed cost models, as you can see. Some of them are quite complicated. Some of them are quite easy. They all turn into dollars and cents. Page 95. I've given you a summary table here of the various cost elements, and how much I have estimated at FCC alone it would take to totally comply to the Cleary settlement. And we see that the total cost figure comes out to be $83,459. There's something else about these elements, too, which I discovered and I'd like to share. And that is that the Cleary settlement is also giving to the inmates a sense of power, a real functional power. An example, Anytime an inmate drops a complaint into the Cleary Monitor box at FCC, according to the settlement agreement, a complaint about the food. Okay, he says, my soup was cold. He drops this into the box. According to the complaint procedure manual, it says that now for the next 5 days, for three meals a day, someone, a correctional officer, has got to take the temperature of all the food that's served and to record this down to be sure that it meets minimum standards. And I did not say that the complaint had to be established as frivolous. Did not say the complaint had to be established as anything, but its existence was there. So what this says to me, if we follow the Cleary complaint to the T, every 5 days, an inmate drops a note in the box, and somebody's going to be taking food temperature. Now, is that good or is that bad? I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm just simply pointing out some of the implications, some of the ramifications of what an interpretation of the Cleary suit means in the optimal compliance situation. So it is an expensive area. Will the institutions actually end up spending that much money? I suspect not. And the reason I suspect not, I address this on page 94, and I say, first, many of the functions were already being done by non-Cleary procedures, and the institution will likely allow these procedures to continue. And second, in some instances, the mandates of Cleary border on ridiculous if one were to attempt to fully implement them. Temperature checks and bedding checks, for example. Results will either be a reduction in the Cleary mandates, which, by the way, as we will see, the court can do, or the difference between the optimal cost and the effort expended will become equal to the amount of litigation that is possible, probably the most costly of all. What I'm saying here is that I think that the attorneys for the plaintiffs are in a position. They have written the Cleary in such a way that if the FCC does not produce the temperature data every day, I assume that they can file complaints and go back to court with it. This is, again, has not happened, but I think the possibilities are there. Well, this leads us to the next question. It's going to cost money. We see that the governor has increased his operational request from approximately $59 to approximately $59 million per year, operations cost, to approximately $70 million for the request that you people are going to consider this year. By the way, if you divide that by 1,500 inmates, it's approximately $50,000 an inmate per year. It's a lot of money, probably the highest in the country. I'll give you an example, the state of Texas spends about $7 a day per inmate, and we spend something like $80 to $90 a day. So we are involved in a very expensive operation here.
Now, water purpose, yes. Senator Bates.
Chairman, one of the things that we were all fearful of last year was a court master. Does the state of Texas, they don't have a master?
Yes, they do.
They do?
Yes.
And they pay $7 a day per inmate, or $7 is the cost?
It costs approximately $7 per day. Yeah, that's the lowest, by the way, that's the lowest in the nation. One reason they do this is that they have a tremendous agricultural enterprise. They grow all their own food. They grow prize Hereford bull herds, and they supply all their own clothes, highly industrialized type of thing. So they're totally different in their approach to using inmate labor. If you visit our institutions here, you'll find idleness is a rule, not production. So there is, and I use Texas just as an extreme case here. But yes, they do have a master.
How does Texas get the inmates to work when they refuse to work?
Well, when I was down there last summer, it was about 10 degrees out in outside, and there was a group who refused to go out that morning, and they were already out in what we call the pen before they boarded the chain bus to the fields, and so they refused to get on the bus, and the administration honestly just said, okay, you can sit there. And they sit there in 110 degrees with no water until about noontime, and they decided they wanted to go to work. Right or wrong, I don't know. You asked a question, and that's the first example that came to mind. My opinion is that most
inmates
want to.
They wouldn't let them go back
to
their cell.
No, they just lock the doors.
But if they let them go back inside to the air conditioning and all that, then there would have been no incentive to go work. And the court allowed that to happen.
Senator, my observations is that most men would prefer to work. If you gave the opportunity for most men, like at FCC, they want to work. They want something to do. There's simply not enough for them to do there. It's been my observations, again, that if you create some meaningful types of work, something that allows the inmates to have some way to do time. They had much rather do that than sit in idleness. I mean, I would rather work than not, had not you. They're no different. They're human. Some of them less human, I have to admit, than others, but about the same. Yeah. So it's not a matter of having a force. If they don't work, there's different ways to encourage them to sit in Texas. But given the opportunity, most will do so. Looked at the relationship between the legislative, executive, and judicial branch of governments. in these settlement matters nationwide. And there's a lot of legal research here, a lot of case documentation, as you can see. The upshot of it is this. My opinion, and this was done by a colleague of mine in Texas, in conjunction with myself. He's an expert in constitutional law in these matters, Dr. Rolando Del Carmen. And our discussions and development of this piece of the work indicates that pretty much once a settlement has been entered into, there's very little that can be done in terms of legislative action. Once the state has put its signature onto the settlement, as in this case we have, it is going to be incumbent for the legislature to produce the money. Now, you say it might be incumbent on us, but what if we don't? Well, we looked at that, and we said, what has happened in states where legislators have said, how much of the increase, Governor, that you're asking for is due to things like the Cleary settlement? Okay, how much of that increase between $59 million and $70 million is due to Cleary? I don't know. Some of it is. And I suspect it's somewhere between $5 and $10 million. And you say, okay, we don't want to fund that. What options do you have? What options does the court have? And we discovered that we also, by the way, wrote to 26 of the states that have entered into these types of agreements. We wrote to the chief legal counsel of the corrections departments and asked them what has happened in their states. And we discovered that in no case has the state ever just said, we're not going to fund for those kinds of activities. The state of Maryland, by the way, the legislators there did initially offer objections to some settlements, and the judge threatened to put everyone in jail. Now, whether you could do that in reality, probably not. And I think people realize that, and I think that's why the states have worked together in the way that they have so far. We have had, in Alabama, the Attorney General was held in contempt and fined to the amount of $1 per inmate per day for overcrowding, the amount of overcrowding. I don't know if he ever paid it or not, honestly, but the judge did hold him in contempt and fine. So judges have been very serious about this. They said, if you're going to enter into agreements, then it is incumbent upon the state to produce the funds. And this has been pretty much the principles upon which courts have operated. My recommendation to you people in the legislature is to be proactive as opposed to being reactive. Once a settlement has gone by, it may be very difficult to change it. But proactivity can take at least one form. One form could be a request on the part of the Attorney General's office before any more of these types of settlements are entered into that you be given an economic assessment, an economic impact on how much the cost is going to be so that you can have some input into what's going on. Because my impression now is that you have had no input into what has been happening. And my impression is that I don't think that we look at the implications economically or socially or operationally of what the state has entered into. And ladies and gentlemen, it is having a tremendous impact on the morale and safety of the operation of our institution. We call staff. So I would say that the legislature should become very proactive and very sensitive to what is happening between the other branches of government, because they're very costly things that are going on. But I lay out in great detail what some of the possibilities are for noncompliance. We cover all the way from receivership to simply administrative input from the judiciary. The last thing which I looked at, actually the last two things, also studied data processing. Several years ago, data processing was atrocious in corrections. It has finally come of age. Data processing is well along its way. There's not much more to say except if the agency wants additional support for data processing, I would highly encourage that. The last thing I looked at was the relationship between institutions of higher education, namely the universities. We have several justice programs in the state. I think we have one at Juneau. I know we have one at Anchorage. We have one at Variance Campus. And we have run very successful internship programs in the past where we have placed our students in correctional positions, both community-based corrections as well as the institutions. In fact, I can name approximately 5 college graduates now who are working in our correctional system, doing very good jobs, who would not have been there unless we'd had an internship program. The Fairbanks campus, we developed our monies with the CETA program out of the federal area, which is now defunct, and we are not capable now of continuing to place our students in corrections And this is something which I would personally ask that the committee consider helping us, at least the Fairbanks, establish our internship again, because it's very important. And this goes back to my original contention that the success of an organization depends upon the quality of the people that are in it. And therein ends the highlights of what we have discovered.
Dr. Kopis, if I might, I'm sure you're aware that our state, we've had a lot of conversations reference to building the maximum security of the institution. My question, I guess, is based on all the steel and concrete that we have in Anchorage and Fairbanks and here in Lemon Creek and Juneau, do we actually need more steel and concrete maximum security type situations? I tend to think, and I haven't had a chance to check it out, the overcrowding is pretty much done by the drunk driving laws and various other nonviolent crimes. Just wondering if it wouldn't be just as cheap to buy a hotel or a motel or something. For classification, put those prisoners who are not a threat to our society into a minimum security institution without buying so much steel and concrete. We're talking $45-65 million. Scares me. What's your feelings on this?
Well, several things come to mind, Senator. First, there's a sort of an accepted rule of thumb that says any state needs approximately 7% of its inmate population in maximum security. Let's round off to 10% so I can do that in my head. And let's say that we even had 2,000 inmates. By the way, we have probably around 1,500 if you consider the 175 or so in the prison system. Maybe 1,500 maximum. Now, let's just take 10% as a rule of thumb to be conservative and liberal and 2,000. That means you only need 200. And we're talking, I just know what I read in the papers. My impression is that we are to construct an 800-bed facility, last I read in the Anchorage paper, and it was to be a facility to house maximum security as well as insane, I think, the terminology was. I don't think we, I'm number one against large institutions, and I consider an 800-bed prison what I call a mega prison. It's much too large. We're going to see smaller units constructed, no more than 300-bed size. Do we need additional prisons at all? The governor's plan here, which I have FY 85 plan, calls for building three additional facilities. And I think it's $32 million a facility over the next 3 years period of time. He also has acknowledged that the increased operational cost is going to incur. So it's a very expensive thing. It doesn't stop just with the building of it. But you asked the question, do I think we need more steel and concrete? My opinion is no, we do not. We do not have the information that has convinced me we do. Let's put it that way. We put people in jail ostensibly for approximately four different reasons. We put them in there to satisfy the need of society's retribution. We put them in there to deter others, to deter themselves, specific and general deterrence. We put them in there for incapacitation, public safety, get them off the streets, and we put them in there to rehabilitate them for different reasons. And the only one of those reasons that could not be served, I'm not sure that's true, by not having to put a DWI person behind concrete and steel is retribution. Some people say we need prisons because society demands we put people in prison. My contention that is not putting a person in prison that is the punishment. It is the social stigma which is attached to it that is the punishment. That social stigma can be attached by putting a person in a much less expensive institution. You do not need electronic locks and doors and steel and concrete to prevent a DWI from escaping. DWIs don't escape. They've been out on their own recognizance for 6 months before they showed up on their own will anyway. So, you know, this idea of keeping them secure is just ridiculous. I suggest that we can certainly use existing structures. We can get people in the community locally where it should be for deterrence purposes. And if we removed that level of inmate from the institution, DWIs who are not escape ready, some of the many misdemeanors which we house in our institutions today, we would probably not need to build additional space for felons. By the way, this is an international trend today, and that is, I just read some stuff about West Germany the other day, and they've just passed laws that says it's very difficult to incarcerate a misdemeanor in a traditional prison. They have the community-based kinds of facilities. You know, you still put them somewhere. You still require them to stay a period of time. But it only takes one person there at night instead of 15 guards. And so, yes, I think that before I would advocate building new facilities, we ought to look at some very real alternatives. And these are some of the data which I don't have. I estimate approximately 40% of the people incarcerated today in Alaska are no threat to the community if let out. To be put on work release. About 40% are non-felons.
Senator Victor Fisher.
Mr. Chairman, I'm very glad you opened this particular direction of conversation because I think this is a key to our not encumbering the state with horrendous costs in the long run. I'm just wondering to what extent, taking this a step further, we in the legislature have not been overloading the system by all the various mandatory sentences that are being handed down whether that is not a much greater burden, for instance, on the state than anything that can come out under the Cleary settlement.
Well, you certainly have tended in the last few years to increase the severity and harshness. Senator, let me just tell you what some things that might counteract that feeling that it's totally your fault. One thing, we increase the harshness of laws. As you know, a prosecuting authority does not have to carry cases forward. You also realize that once a case is carried forward, juries do not have to convict. So when we increase the harshness of laws, indeed for those who are convicted and who are sentenced, are going to stay there longer periods of time. As we remove in our presumptive sentencing that we have, we remove probation possibilities, we remove parole possibilities, we put them there for long periods of time. Once a person is convicted, indeed, they're going to stay there a long period of time. But I suspect that we're probably not convicting as many people as we used to. Now, that's just a speculation. This is based on some research that has been found in other states. Other states have experienced the same legislative tendency to increase the harshness of laws. Criminologists have looked at the effects, and these are some of the things that we're finding out, that juries tend not to convict as much. We're overloading the system at the court level, that's for sure. For example, the DWI laws, I looked at the proportion of people who used to plead guilty at arraignment on DWI, and they'd be accused and say, yes, I was, and I'll take the medicine. With the increased penalties, people now are beginning to plead not guilty. They're beginning to demand a trial, and we're stacking the courts up. In fact, in yesterday's USA newspaper, I was reading on the plane coming in last night, front page article about how DWI laws have just inundated the courts. So it's affecting the system, but I think probably affecting the courts as much, if not more, than corrections. You are part of the problem, and the laws are part of the problem. But I think that it's not a matter of necessarily taking these laws off the books as to begin to legislate the alternatives that judges may have in dealing with the problems. I would rather see a judge for a group of DWIs, I'd rather see him say, okay, on January 31st, we have a class beginning. It's going to last for 72 hours. And we've rented the suites at a local motel down here. And we have a group of clinical psychologists who are going to run the DWI seminar, and you're going to be incarcerated for 72 hours, and you're going to be under a clinical supervision program. You see, because we can monitor the effects of these kinds of things. Once a judge sends a person to prison, we lose control of what happens to that person. We turn that person's fate, we turn that person's amount of punishment over to the inmate population. We don't know what happens to people when they go to jail. Another thing that's interesting, I spend a lot of time with police officers and riding at night, and we pick up DWIs. I talk to them, and you'd be surprised once a DWI gets picked up, he's not physically any better off, but he becomes very mentally astute. Yeah, he kind of knows what's going on, so these are not just total mental defects I'm talking to. But I ask them questions. I say, listen, do you know what's going to happen to you?
No.
Do you know what the laws are in the state?
No.
You know how much you're going to have to bail out, how much it's going to cost you to bail out? No. Do you think you're going to have to spend time in jail? I don't know. You know, the laws that we pass, we hope have deterrent value, and I think that they do to some extent, but not to the degree that perhaps we think. If we take a person after the fact, however, and we subject them to what I call this clinical psychological sentencing pattern, we can study that. We can see what works and what doesn't, because it's almost a laboratory setting. And we can develop, I think, therefore, programs which can affect deterrence and can rehabilitate people. Right now, all rehabilitation is totally up to the whims of the inmate subculture. It happens because once a fellow walks into that prison, we lose control over it. That's another reason I'm against mega prisons, is that the inmate population subculture grows in strength and in magnitude, and we lose more and more control over what happens to people after their sentence.
I would like to, if I could, make a comment here on this. In addition to what Dr. Kopas is saying, I think and Senator Fisher, that even though there may be no change in the presumptive sentencing law and that the sentencing goes on, I think the issue of a mega prison, as is referred to, or some other type of incarceration, you have to look at cost-to-benefit analysis in it. Is it really worthwhile to build an extremely large or a number of 300, 400-bed prisons to incarcerate these people who will adjust to the return to society maybe much easier in a motel-type complex where they don't have to go through three sets of locked, barred doors, two sets of barbed wire. A few years ago, I was a police officer in North Dakota. Our DWI cases were all held in the county jail. Sure, there was a set of bars there. Sometimes they weren't locked. And it was in the courthouse building. We had another prison, but they didn't have to go there because they didn't deserve that type of treatment, if you will. I think there's a cost-to-benefit analysis that has to be done on this, and it's not going to be just the cost per prisoner necessarily, but you have to look at these sentences, the different types of classifications of felonies, misdemeanors, et cetera.
If I might object, one thing that has bothered me personally for a lot of years, that's the thought that in the stream of our society, when a person causes, be it a minor infraction, it's not like the rest of our nation to where he will go to the city jail. Or at worst, he'll go to the county jail. We don't have those facilities. Our citizens go from the sidewalk to the state pen. Boom. There has to be some problems here. Am I way off base, Dr. Kopas? I'd appreciate your professional.
Well, I wish I had one, sir. That's something which, in all honesty, in my mind, the creation of a county-based jail system, which incarcerates pretrial and misdemeanors. I don't know. I keep vacillating back and forth on whether that would be advisable for Alaska or not. The jail systems down south, they're terrible. I visited quite a number of county jails, and there's some places I just wouldn't want to spend any time. But on the other hand, they do serve a very meaningful function, as you're saying. It separates the felon from the misdemeanor. So that's the other side of it, you know. I don't know. I really don't. There's one thing I would like to say, and that is that we should be very careful to avoid an institutional mentality in the state. I don't like prisons. Prisons are necessary. There are a certain portion of our people, of any society, I think have to be locked up. And I'm for that. I don't want them, you know, I don't want my children exposed to them downtown any more than anybody else does. But I think that we perhaps have passed that point of how many people can we lock up. As my friend in Fairbanks and I were debating this one day, and I said, well, how many do you want to lock up, John? He said, well, let's just lock up half of them, and the other half of the population will watch them. Every 10 years we'll swap. And I said, well, you know, I don't know. How many people can we put behind bars? And I heard a juvenile judge one time say, never forget, Judge Susan Rochette. She was a juvenile judge in New York City. And she says that it always amazed her that no matter how many prisons you build, they always seem to fill up. Always seem to fill up and overflow, you see. And I think that perhaps at some point the decision to build prisons is an arbitrary decision. And the decision to stop building prisons is also an arbitrary decision. And I think we're at that point.
Well,
I think we can make the decision, at least for a while, to step back and take a look to see. And I would hope to see that that comes out non-institutional, if possible, except for those people that need to be there.
Senator Sackett?
In the study, you talk about the Terry settlement and what has occurred out of that in terms of the settlement. Could you give us your views as to exactly what you think should have come out of there in terms of the case that was brought before the court and your views in terms of what ultimately has come out?
Okay. As you're aware, they are having a trial. There are certain parts that now have actually gone to trial the last few weeks, Mankers. There are a lot of things in the Cleary settlement which are good. Many of those things, however, the institutions were already doing. Okay, a lot of what's in the Cleary settlement is just guaranteeing what was already being done in many of the institutions. Institutions in Alaska, relatively speaking, are very fine institutions. There are some things in there, however, which I think ought to have been debated and litigated in open court. For example, the telephones. Okay, nowhere would the Constitution of the United States or Alaska ever demand that we give the amount of telephone privileges which we do to inmates. Now, whether it's right or wrong, I'm not sure. Inmates right now virtually have open access to telephones in the institutions. They have, in the Cleary settlement, it says, for example, if their television breaks within so many hours, like 12 hours or whatever it is, the institution must have a fixed repairable television. When we begin to put those types of mandates and structures on an institution, so within 12 hours you have to do this, it seems to me to imply that the institution is not interested in doing its job otherwise. And I don't believe that. I believe that the institutions, the people that I know in Alaskan Corrections are very interested in doing their job and doing it well. And so when the state has all of a sudden entered into these agreements without virtue of court action litigation, I think the way it comes down, Senator, is more important than the contents of it. But you asked what I thought about the contents. I do not think that the inmate should have the ability to require that the institutional personnel have to take the temperature of food just because someone drops a note in a box and says, my soup is cold. I think that's bad. I think that that the state should have kept a lot of its discretion about how much telephone privileges should be allowed. I do think the inmates should have access to telephones, but I think that the state should have been able to make decisions institution by institution as to how much should be allowed. I wonder personally just how many obscene phone calls are originating out of that institution now. I don't know. I do know that the female officer at FCC receives obscene phone calls, and they traced it back to the men's section. They were calling her up on the other end. You know, it makes you wonder sometimes what goes on. I think we should have maintained the ability to closely monitor the usage of the telephone. I do not think that the institution should be required every day to go around to 144 checkpoints to take the temperature. I think the state ought to have had the alternative to work with their staff and say, listen, we want to maintain a decent institution. If an inmate has a complaint, go in and see what the problem is. But to have to go every day, 7 days a week, I do not think that was good. I think about, I don't know, probably half or more of the things that the Cleary suit demands should not be forced upon an institution.
Okay, what is the status of the suit now and the settlement? I know they're doing portions, but do you know specifically where we are?
The best I can respond to is that we have entered into it, and as the state has agreed to do these things. At Fairbanks, there is a full-time person
promoted to a CO3 position, known as a query monitor. He has two assistants, and they are working very hard to implement the Cleary decision at FCC. It is the impression of everyone in the system that they must strive toward compliance as soon as possible. So to answer your question, I assume, yes, it is in the institutions, and they are working very, very hard at trying to meet the compliance mandates, but they're not going to do it. It's going to cost too much.
Senator Pinkston, Senator Ferguson.
Chairman, you stated earlier, I think, that once we've entered into the agreement, it's too late to do anything, so it's too late to do anything about the telephone privileges and the soup temperature and that kind of thing?
That's probably up to Judge Cerdilli.
But what would have to happen before the to get Judge Cerdilli to rule upon? Would the state have to say, we want to renege on this part of the agreement, or what?
The state would have to ask the court's permission to modify the settlement. And, you know, it just be standard request, I guess.
Someone would have to go
and say, listen, we think that this temperature thing is costing us $84,000 a year at FCC. It's ridiculous, and we want to change. The judge does have the power to change a consent decree.
I think on that temperature one, on page 27, Dr. Copas has summarized some of this, but just looking real quick, I'm just going to read one part here. It says, defendants shall maintain temperatures between 65 degrees and 80 degrees at all times. If temperatures exceed 80 degrees, they'll shake, or go less than 65, you'll take steps to correct that. I don't think anybody can disagree with a temperature range of 65 to 80 degrees. And looking at that, that's what the Cleary settlement says, basically, as summarized. And if you read the settlement, I read the settlement, and looking for cost points and to develop this cost model, my question was, well, what do we do? Set one thermometer in the middle of the institution and look at it. Well, that's one alternative. That's not very good compliance. Another alternative would be to, for example, on the Fairbanks institution, there are a number of wings. Measure the temperature, say, in the hallway, in the one wing where there may be 30 cells. If it's okay there, it should be okay in the cells, unless there is some other complaints. The 144 checkpoints were come up with by the Fairbanks monitor, the state monitor, and so forth, and as a determination of what they felt were the number of checkpoints to or required to be looked at to meet the 65 to 80 degrees. Now, there may be some way to modify the interpretations on that, I'm not sure. But I was rather surprised that there were 144 checkpoints, but when it was explained that that's every cell, every recreation area, cafeteria, etc., there are 144. I think you could cut that down to 20 if you did hallways. There may be some type of adjustment that way.
Well, I think, Senator, if you look on page 105, perhaps would address your question here, and that is, what can we do? How can we get the decree changed? And this is what I observe out of the case law, which talks about the concept of retention of jurisdiction. Remember that the court now, by virtue of the agreement, has retained a jurisdictional power over the operations of corrections. And it's called retention of jurisdiction. And as one writer observed, it facilitates enforcement of the order by establishing the court's readiness to use more drastic methods if necessary. I go on to explain that retention of jurisdiction also can result in the court modifying the agreement. And I list about five types of modifications and give examples where the courts have actually modified their consent decrees within these five types throughout the nation in different courts. So these are ways that the state can ask for and achieve modification. But the crux of it is now placed in the hands of the judiciary.
Senator Perkins was next, unless it's a follow-up.
Yeah, it's just a follow-up. So you say that your opinion is there could be 20 checkpoints. The Cleary decree just says between 65 and 80, period, right? I mean, basically, that's what it says. So who decided the 144? Under whose order was the intent carried beyond common sense, I would think?
The state has a statewide Cleary compliance monitor. Special
Who's
position.
He getting his orders from?
That I do not know, Senator.
Excuse me, is this a corrections officer, or who is this person?
Sir, I, I,
I do not think he's a corrections officer, but I do not know that for sure. He's located in Anchorage. I met the gentleman briefly. What's his name? I do know he was with a gentleman named Kevin Bruce at the time that I met him.
Does he work in the office of the commissioner?
Where's Kevin Bruce working now?
The compliance monitor was with Mr. Bruce at the time that I met him. And his name just simply escapes me.
Senator Ferguson, then Senator Sackett.
Yeah. In your report, you give very good examples in your cost model. But am I reading the report right that the Department of Law should give detailed reports as to what it is costing us and what it will cost us in the Clara case?
Yes, sir. That is my recommendation, because I believe that if we were to have looked at the cost components, we would have been able to foresee the future implications of noncompliance, how much it's going to cost. And I think that at that time, the state probably would have not entered into a non-litigated settlement, but would have gone to court, and these issues would have been debated, and different conclusions would have been reached. Right. So I would say that a cost impact should always be developed before any such settlement is entered into.
Is it too late for the Department of Law to do this?
Again, my opinion is once the settlement has been entered into, that we have turned control over to the judiciary. The study of case law says that to me. Yes, that now that we've entered into it, you can't back out of it. If the plaintiffs demand that you spend $84,000 at FCC a year to take temperature, you're either going to do it or you're going to be held in contempt of court. You have entered into an agreement, and you just don't renege. It's not a matter of Indian giving.
Senator Sackett.
At some time, I'd like to perhaps hear from the Department of Law and the Department of Corrections with regard to some of these problems that we have here. Because I know, as a committee, we were concerned last year with what was happening with the Department of Law and the people that they had on there working on a settlement. I'd also like to get a status as to exactly where we are in the case, because I know portions of it have been settled, but the entire case has not been settled, and find out what those specific areas are that have not been settled yet, and who's interpreting all of this.
Are there any other questions by the members of the committee? Okay, thank you very much. We certainly appreciate the input. Hey, committee member, have anything to bring up at this time?
Form a call committee to order. First thing this morning is bill assignments. Committee substitute presented bill 326. An act relating to constitutional spending limits, Senator Sackett. Senate Bill 383, an act making a special appropriation to the Department of Law and Education for miscellaneous claims, Senator Bennett. Senate Bill 390, an act relating to the Permanent Fund Dividend Distribution Program, Senator Bob Mulcahy. Committee substitute for Senate Bill 331, an act relating to the preparation of the executive budget, Senator Ferguson. Committee substitute for Senate Bill 336, an act relating to the federal crop insurance, Senator Vic Fisher. Senate Bill 364, an act making a special appropriation to the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, Senator Sackett. Senate Bill 365, an act making a supplemental appropriation of legislators' salaries, Senator Bates. Senate Bill 382, an act relating to payment of costs of postmortem examination, Senator Josephson. Before us this morning, we have a committee substitute for House Bill 142, an act making a special appropriation to the Department of Commerce and Economic Development for payment of grants to the Iditarod Trail Committee. Is there anyone that's here to testify?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Representative Ron Larson. I am the prime sponsor of this bill. And basically, at this time, I'd like to answer any questions that you may have. Or I also have in the audience today Mayor Leo Rasmussen, who's the mayor of the city of Nome. Leo is very knowledgeable about the race itself, and he too has agreed to give any testimony that you may desire.
Questions from any of the senators? Senator Figgs.
Mr. Chairman, I support this measure. I think it's a viable race. It's historical. It brings in a lot of tourism dollars. I think it's a very small sum of money for the amount of money that's generated, for the publicity that Alaska gets in a very positive way across the country, the various media experts and media people that come from all over the world for this event, and I would move this bill out of committee, sir.
Yeah, motion before the committee prior to that, and that the good mayor...
Sorry. If I had been here on time, I would have known that.
having the mayor here, he has come a long way. Mayor, do you wish to make any statements before we move the bill out of committee?
Mr. Chairman, if you're moving out of committee, I think we're going as much as you can. I'm all over the Iditarod Trail Committee Board of Directors. And the state has generally, since 1975, made a donation to the Iditarod. Of course, I think you're aware last year that things sort of fell through the cracks and nothing came wrong. And it is hoped that this will come up and as a matter of support on the part of the state to help facilitate. Anywhere from $10 to $20 million worth of promoting for the state of Alaska, very meager budget, around $250 million. And I am very much in favor of the base. But for Mary, if you have any questions, I'm glad to be able to vote for
it. Any questions from the senators, Mayor Rasmussen? If not, the motion is before the committee to move the bill out. Individual recommendations, all in favor? Bill moved out, individual recommendations. Is there anything further to come before the committee
Thank
at
you.
This time? Senator Figgs.
Mr. Chairman, as long as the mayor's here, it came to my attention last night when I was doing some research on this that there are 8 parcels of land from Kinnick to Susitna that's in private hands, that the trail goes over, the historical trail, and that the purchase price of the right-of-way would be $300,000. And I have no backup on this. I know nothing else about this except this much. And I was wondering if any of the rest of the committee knew, or if the mayor, if he has material like that, if he could supply it to the committee.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, I do have that information, and we'll get it to your office.
It would, you know, I just, if the subdivision all of a sudden sprung up across that trail, it would sort of be lost forever, I would think.
And we, if you'd provide that to Senator Fakes, subcommittee, and brief the committee on it. Anything further to come before the committee? If not, thanks, Chairman. Order. Item on the calendar this morning, Senate Bill 312. An act creating the Office of Public Advocacy.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Art Snowden, Administrative Director of the Alaska Court System. I have with me Mr. Richard Barrier, Deputy Director for Services. Staff counsel Carla Forsythe is in the room. She's here on testifying on other legislation, and she can answer any substantive questions. She is primarily responsible for in the drafting of this legislation. The reason that this legislation is so desperately needed is, as you know, we've been doing conflict cases, as is mandated, when the public defender is preempted out of the case because of conflicts. And we've been putting them out, obviously, in the private bar with monies that the legislature have given us for that purpose. Our court rule right now says that we pay $40 an hour up to a max of $2,500 unless there's extraordinary circumstances. By the time you have murder cases and things like that and you have to give more money, we're paying them an effective rate of about $30 an hour. The average rate for an attorney in this state is over $120, as the legislature knows. I have right now 5 lawsuits filed against me. I've been cutting the bills based on the budget, that we can't afford it, not the merit, and we have already put a couple of attorneys out of business. Unfortunately, we didn't do that on purpose, the small firms, and we didn't know it. We didn't allow extra monies, and they have this obligation to do it. We think that if this lawsuit and the Attorney General is representing us, we've discussed if any of these lawsuits are successful, it will cost the state 3 to 4 times what you're paying right now for these services. They've been working basically for free over the years. No other profession does that, as you well know, doctors or anybody else. Beyond that, the guardian ad litem function, which is in the court system at this time, the legislature has given us about 8 people for that, and that we would transfer those people over. That is a health and social services or a Department of Administration type of function. What happened in that bill His representative, then Representative Parr, passed the bill. He felt that the executive branch wasn't operating efficiently, and he put it in the judicial branch. What these people have to do is older people who have no relatives are basically, we provide guardians for them. That means they get their food stamps for them, they get their clothes for them, they take them to the doctors. Obviously, not a court function, and the governor agrees that it should be in the executive branch, as they agree that the other function should be in the executive branch. The public defender, which we're modeling this bill after, in their annual report will show you that their average cost per case is about $500 or $600, which is about a third of ours, you know, with conflicts, and it's going to go up. And the conflict cases go up every single year. We honestly believe that having the state do this as a second public defender's office will save the state tremendous amounts of money over the long run, especially if these lawsuits are successful, and I think that they have a good chance of being successful. The Attorney General is worried about defending them. The governor has agreed to take over the function. We think it will be both cost-effective to the state, and we think it will provide better defense representation to litigants. Right now, you give an attorney $2,000 or $2,500 for a murder case, and they work on it, but I would, you know, the work that can go in a murder case is a tremendous amount, and they know there's going to be no compensation for it, so sometimes I question possibly the level of defense in certain cases. Well, we believe it's an absolute necessity that this happens, because we honestly believe that the state will end up paying tremendously more for these services if it doesn't. And the Attorney General and the governor agree with our assessment after going through it, and think it'll save the state money in the long run, and that it will certainly stop what we consider a tremendous worry, and that's in the future, if we have this and these lawsuits are successful, a tremendous drain on state finances. As this committee knows, in the 11 years that I've been director of the courts, we've come in for one supplemental, and that was for these types of conflict services. It's something we have no control over. That just depends on how many indigents commit crime, allegedly, and there's a conflict. This year, we are faced with the possibility of having come in with our second supplemental in 11 years. As you know, in Anchorage, there was a tremendously large cocaine bust, 23 people arrested. On the Kenai Peninsula, another very large narcotics bust with another 12 or 13. Most of those people show no visible signs of income. They will be represented. The costs are going to be tremendous. If you have a state agency, the way we envision it being set up, those cases can be passed back and forth among those people. There won't be as many conflicts, and the state, we expect, would save a lot of money. I'd be glad to answer any questions. We can answer budgetary questions or substantive questions with regard to the legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to refresh myself on this, because you appeared before Judiciary also. In the criminal area, then there would be a kind of junior public defender office that would handle just the conflict items.
Except that we have suggested that it be set up in a different manner than the public defender office. Instead of an office like the public defender, say, with six or seven attorneys in it, we've suggested to the executive branch that they set up six or seven independent little offices, which wouldn't cost any more money or very little more for secretarial, but then they could move the conflicts, as you know, as a lawyer, between each other, because they would not have the ethical conflict that you do in one office with central files and so on and so forth, where they are precluded by the canons of conduct from doing that.
So there'd be very small offices that could handle that work.
Yes.
And this legislation is not opposed by the private bar, because you're relieving, in that respect, you're relieving the private bar of what has been burdensome to some.
That's correct. There's a present lawsuit in the court suit where the private bar is asking for a minimum of $80 an hour with no cap. That is at the Superior Court level now. Obviously, they'd be willing to do it at that, because they're not going to lose a lot of money under that, except some overhead. But based on the present structure and the financial condition of the state, the private bar certainly doesn't want to do it. They've been acting basically pro bono for tremendous numbers of years and providing this service for free to the state, and no other profession in the state provides that type of thing.
Mr. Chairman,
And
the suits against you, are they based on challenges to the involuntary servitude aspect of it, or are they based on the what is deemed to be the failure of the system to pay a contracted fee or authorized fee.
They're based on a number of things. One is the involuntary service dude. One is us saying that we cannot afford it, and they're saying whether you can afford it or not, the state has X amount of money, and you can't use that as a defense, that you don't have it. The state does, and they should pay their bills. They're based on both those types of theories. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, that's cruel and inhuman punishment. This is your problem.
That's what professionals they call. That's what they call going for the deepest pocket. Senator Sackett.
Going for the deepest pocket. You mentioned that the public defender charges or averages $500, $600 per case, and what was it in the courts?
That's pretty much what their annual report says. They divide the number of cases that the public defender has into their budget, and they can do it a lot more inexpensively than the private bar because they're not maintaining large separate offices around the state and so on and so forth. Yes, sir.
And how much does the court do it?
$1,500 approximately now if we average out, but I've been cutting those bills back so far. That includes pleas and trials. Obviously, we have those cases that go up into the $20,000, $30,000. We have numbers of bills in my office for $50,000, $60,000. I cut them. They put in hundreds of hours on major cases. Okay. We cut them back, but the cost, we believe, is more expensive.
I can't understand what happens when it goes to administration. I know that's not your department, but you've obviously looked at it already.
Yes,
there's two fiscal notes from there, and if it costs $500, $600 per case with the public defender, and it costs you $1,500, you would think that if it was transferred over, there would be one-third less.
Approximately
a third.
We project
two-thirds more work in the department administration.
Excuse me, Senator, I'm sorry. Through the chair, we projected in our original numbers that there'd be a $300,000 saving in this initial year. The department administration feels with the uncertainty and the setup and not knowing the number of cases, rather than see that get off in such a way that they're very deep in the hole, that if we did a wash on the budget, if the cases keep climbing, it certainly will be justified like they came up this year. If not, they may have some monies they could return to the general fund, but they would hate the worry of being underfunded in the first year of taking over a new responsibility such as this. But we did project in our original numbers that they would save about $300,000 over present costs, Senator.
Senator Jones?
In all fairness, Mr. Snowden, it would seem to me that the kind of case that would result in a conflict is probably more complex on the average than the total mill. That is because a conflict only arises when you have co-defendants,
four people.
Pardon?
When you have two poor people.
No,
that's why we get involved in it.
Those cases involve questions of...
Can we explain conflict?
Okay. Carla, or you can help me with this, but the situation is A and B are charged with burglary or murder or any kind of crime. When the attorney interviews A and B, A says it's B's fault and B says it's A's fault. In that situation, the attorney can't represent both. That's a simplified version of it.
Mm-hmm.
Those kinds of cases where you have two different defendants and discovery problems, and is this piece of evidence admissible against A and B or only against A, those become more complicated than the single defendant cases on the average, isn't it?
That is true, but the other scenario is that you have a person who commits a crime and who's being represented by the public defender and then is charged with another offense. Even in that sense, the public defender has found basic conflicts. They're already representing someone's a victim of another crime, has been charged with a crime. They have conflicts under the canons that they can't handle both defendants.
That goes into another budget. So you're looking at two budgets, basically. Public defender's budget, where they have one person there, and then this budget. So you combine them, and then the costs start going higher. I still don't know why it costs us more to go to administration. I mean, over time, as you look through budgets for different years, you find different departments have a tendency to come in with big fiscal notes, and some departments don't. Over time, the administration within the last 2 years has traditionally come in with big fiscal notes, regardless of what the workload is. And they have one for $2,395,500, another one for $324,100. And that's higher than what we're paying you right now.
Mr. Berry, do you want to address it?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Sackett, one aspect of this... one aspect of the bill is that it does cover more than just the criminal cases. There are the guardian ad litem cases, which are attorneys or guardian representing children or young kids, whatever, in dependency cases, these kind of cases. And there's also the Public Guardian Program. And those two programs make up quite a bit of the bill or the program, and are not necessarily, you know, a whole lot cheaper. I mean, the Guardian people are already employees. They'll simply be transferred over. And the Guardian ad litem work probably would not be, you know, that much difference between one agency and the other. So it's not all just the criminal part. That part we think there should be some savings in, but again, it's hard to project that until it's actually set up. And dealing with the double conflict, it's not clear how much they'll actually save on it.
Senator, on that beat, it's a three-part program. We've considered two parts to be a wash. One where we transfer our public guardian people over. They should do it for the same cost it costs us. We don't see any other cost than that we had. The guardian ad litem program should cost about the same also. So only the savings we project are in the public, the conflict case area, which is about a third of the bill. Okay. The savings would be in that third, not over the whole number that is in the fiscal note. Of that, we projected that they would save about some monies, but we're not, you know, as I said, it's a startup, it's a new agency in that sense, then we're predicting that's our best guess of what we hope will happen. We really believe that it's going to be a tremendous savings over having the private bar handle this over time, because if they do win $80 an hour or something, then we basically face with tripling or quadrupling what we request in that area.
I know you're not the right person to answer this, but it doesn't reflect the savings. That's what I'm telling you. If you look at FY 86 and 87 under those two fiscal notes, one jumps to $1,806,000 from $324,000. Other one, add on another about $250,000 next year, and it keeps it going up every year. We're doing well within your own.
Mr. Chairman,
court system. I like it there.
I think we do our best. I think the Department of Administration is here and could explain that. There would be some natural growth in those budgets, even if they remained in our area. Obviously, as the caseload goes up and those number of cases go up, but I don't know what's in their fiscal notes. And the Department of Administration is here and can answer that.
Just a minute.
Wait a minute, I'm not ready for the part.
Senator Fix has a question or two.
I'm still running around on the basic program here. Today, right now, you have public defenders employed in the judicial system?
No, they're under the Department of Administration.
The public defenders are attorneys out of law schools. They are employed by the Department of Administration now.
Yes.
How many of them are there?
Statewide?
Oh, 30.
Okay, so right now, then what happens? You have a person commits a crime out there, and who decides whether they get a public defender or not?
The judge is whether they're in.
Okay, so then the judge says you need a public defender, and the public defender comes running out of the Department of Administration.
And they say we have a conflict, let's say that.
Okay, so you need another attorney. Can't you go get another public defender?
No, you cannot.
No. So then you have to then go into private practice and find somebody.
Yes.
Okay, so your theory is if you set up all these smaller offices around the state, when the judge says you have a conflict, Fairbanks and you can get a public defender out of Anchorage, a public defender out of Fairbanks, and they can arrive at it. They can each.
Which case is back and forth with this new type of.
Okay. All right, got it. Now, you would be giving up your guardianship thing.
We would.
You would transfer those eight people who are now employed by the judiciary branch.
That's correct.
To the Department of Administration.
Okay.
Now, the Department of Administration is saying, and I should probably ask them this, to run this program right now, they need additional people to do that.
Well, they will when the function is transferred.
They will no longer be contracting with the private sector.
That's correct.
These complications. Okay.
There will still be some contracts in some small areas and for occasional cases, but the bulk of the work will be done by the personnel.
Okay. Why, then, do we have a grant program in the Department of Commerce and Community Affairs for Alaska Legal Services? What do they do? How do they play into all this?
Alaska Legal
Services. And be careful, because he's sitting right back here.
Alaska Legal Services is basically a nonprofit lawyers for the poor on civil cases. There is no constitutional mandate in any civil area that we provide representation.
So what we're setting up is a nonprofit
criminal.
State employee criminal division.
That's right.
For the poor.
And there is a constitutional mandate in that area.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I now understand.
Okay.
I think.
Senator Joseph?
Two matters. First, as a point, Art, I think you explained in judiciary that there is a question of inappropriateness in having the judge appoint the advocate who is to persuade the judge. That's one of the problems here. So to get that process out of the court system is deemed desirable. It seems to me, let me try this on, following Senator Sackett, the fiscal note indicates that the public advocacy caseload, where third-party conflicts arise, is 10% of the, is about 10% of the totality. Pardon? And if your savings in that category were to be about a third, is that right?
Our saving would be in the public defender conflicts, not in the guardianship area.
The 10% is third-party triple conflicts, not double conflicts. So the savings would come in both the double and the triple. That's for both of those, we're hiring attorneys to do the work.
For the non-lawyer member, the triple conflict would be, say, there's three people charged. The public defender takes one, conflict office takes the other one, the third one goes somewhere else.
Well, what portion of the total budget is attributable to the criminal caseload as to which your in-house experience is cheaper than your...
Roughly, I think close to half of the total dollars in there would be. Roughly, so, say $1.2 million, something like that, would be criminal payments.
And would there be savings as to that segment of the total, wouldn't it?
We estimated there would be. The Department of Administration, not being sure with a new function, does not want to be underfunded in their first year setting up, and they're estimating a wash, as I understand it. I have not read their fiscal notes.
Well, they seem to be very scared because they're relying on your figures, they say.
Well, that's true.
But they have our budget, and we've done it. It's not just we're guessing. This is our experience in our budget over the years of what it's costing us. Admittedly, when you set up the employees and that type of thing, the cost breakdown may be different. Get out to the private sector, those are actual numbers that, you know, we can show by audit is what we spent. Our problem is the escalation and our worry that that will triple or quadruple very rapidly. This lawsuit the Attorney General is worried about, the court is worried about it. It is a function that shouldn't appertain to the courts, because when you have a judge appointing an advocate, other people think that he's going to be, there's going to be favoritism there. Certainly appearance problems. A real problem for us.
Well, we could reduce this figure theoretically by $300,000 to $400,000 and see what your experience is, and we would be in the ballpark of where we might well turn out given the anticipated savings, isn't that right?
You might if you talked to them and said if you can come in and show us where the expenses are, and it's more, that you would grant a supplemental. I would hate for them to start to do something and not have the opportunity to do it right.
Right.
Mr. Snowden, can I ask a question, please? Now, defending the people, what various agencies, divisions, nonprofits, and what have you do we have? We have Alaska Legal Services, Public Defender. Do we have ACLU? Do we have, what else do we have out there?
We do not. First of all, no criminal defense work that I know is being done by Alaska Legal Services. They're working primarily in rural Alaska, assisting people in the civil area. The only group that we have doing criminal defense work is the public defender and the private bar under contract or under order from the court. The ACLU is a nonprofit group that, when they see a big constitutional question, will supply an attorney to go in, and if they have standing to argue in a case. It's not an organized office of people, it's just attorneys who, in their view, see constitutional questions that merit a very close look from an independent view, and one of those attorneys then will try to represent that interest. It is not an organization such as you can find in one local office.
And generally not at the trial stage, only on appeal.
Just on the appeal level, yes.
One step further with his question. Don't we have a situation where hospitals and where you're poor, they'll give you an operation anyway? Doesn't always, there isn't a good Samaritan type concept there.
Not that I know.
Doctors won't charge you if you're poor in some cases. I mean, they do have a policy, I think. Do attorneys have that policy, too?
Well, the attorneys look at it this way, and I think there's some merit there, that they say, we don't mind doing what we consider pro bono work, helping poor and so on and so forth, but we should choose where we want to be charitable, those cases and those types of things. We should not be ordered to go do a case for basically nothing. And to, and which would also affect the rest of our practice. We have clients and things to do. They've been doing it for years. I think the bar and I deserve some credit for everything they've done in the past. We look at them as they should be doing it. But when you think about it, that they're doing this work for free, they're doing it by order. They're the only profession that I know that does it systematically.
Well, the hospital sends a bill to the state in this situation.
The hospital sends a bill to the state, or they have federal Medicaid payments, and a number of hospitals won't take even Medicaid types of people. That type of thing, Senator. I think in the attorney's profession, to give them credit, they do more pro bono work for the poor than any other profession that I know.
I think, if I might, just for the clarity, Senator Sackett is right. The physicians do donate time to the crippled children. They donate time to any number of areas where there is no compensation. School physicals in many communities are...
But they are not mandated to do it by the state, as the attorneys basically are.
They like to say they do it because they're nice guys. Any further questions of
Mr. Chairman, have you considered any other alternative?
We considered all alternatives. We've been trying to contract over the last few years as possible. Those contracts themselves are very expensive, and I think the last person we contracted is thinking of suing us, too. But,
let me ask you about that, because you did put out the bid on some of this work with the idea that instead of scattering around, you'd have one or two conflict firms. And I think, I remember, I may have even submitted a proposal to Senator Lody or something. Whatever happened to that?
We do have contract terms right now, but they're expensive. What's the cost of them?
Could you look at
it? Anchorage itself is probably close to $400,000.
Just for the Anchorage cases, we have a conflict contract that's in excess of $400,000. You know, they do not submit contracts that they're going to lose money on.
Right.
And we feel, from the state experience in the public defender area, that we honestly believe that this is the most rational, efficient way to go. We are the first state to attempt it on a statewide basis. Other states have tried it on a county level, and it has worked. It's an urgent thing from where we are because of the lawsuits and the other areas we're not, shouldn't even be in, like the public guardian area and so on and so forth. And I hate to face you with this dilemma, but I'm faced with the dilemma myself. In fact, as I said, we're faced with possibly having come in for a supplemental, and those costs are rising, and they're non-controllable costs. Police arrest people. They have a right to defense, and it's something we have no control over in this area.
And the other side of it is, without casting aspersions on anybody, you could have a situation where an attorney might do more than reasonably necessary in the expectation that either through a court suit or otherwise, the meter could run, or she could get reimbursed for whatever.
Well, that is correct. They have found me to be very hard-hearted, and that meter has been cut off by me, and that's why I've got all these lawsuits against me.
Any further questions?
Thank you, sir.
We have a representative of the administration. Did you wish to testify on the bill?
I don't know if there are questions.
Yeah.
It appears that there is. If you step forward and state your name, who you represent for the record, please.
My name is Christine Dooley, and I'm the finance officer for the Division of Administrative Services for the Department of Administration.
Senator Fakes.
In your narrative here of your fiscal note, and the fiscal note I'm talking about is the one revision date, January 16th, it's the $2,395,000. In the fourth paragraph down, you say that you are adding two new accounting technicians to handle the increased responsibilities of another division within the department. These positions are for additional professional contracts, which I thought we were avoiding, vendor payment, which I thought we were avoiding. So I want to know, and then I can understand payroll functions for the three new offices. I can understand that one. But I don't understand professional contracts and vendor payments.
Okay. First of all, there will continue to be some contractual work with the public advocacy as we see it, because there are third-party conflicts.
But you're going to have three offices. And Arthur said you could switch between your three offices.
There's been a lot of discussion about that, and that may or may not come to pass. But it's at this point in time, it is our impression that we will have to have third-party conflict contracts.
Mr. Chairman, will there be three offices?
Yes, there will be.
Okay, and is there a legal opinion as to whether those three offices could handle a gang burglary or something? Arthur's.
I am not an attorney, and perhaps we would ask Carla to answer that question.
For the record, I'm Carla Forsyth, general counsel to the court system. Mr. Chairman, Senator Fakes, the legislation is a very broad outline. Some of these details would have to be worked out as we go along. The thinking right now is that there would be three officers. Those would handle the bulk of the cases, but there are going to be times when there would be a conflict for the office to handle some cases, even if you split them up between offices. There will still need to be a mix of contractual services with the office. It will be a mix, and we can't tell you exactly what proportion it will be right now.
Wait a second.
Okay. Looking at your backup on your fiscal notes, Chris, you've got to redo them because you don't have any explanation of what you're going to do with $2,395,000. There's no breakdown whatsoever on that, and I would think that if you're going to take the program someplace, you must have that breakdown. You've done the analysis.
We can submit
need that.
Further detail, yes.
We need that. Also,
okay.